hi. It's recording.
And the front is you guys, the back is me.
Awesome.
And let's even. Yeah. Do a backup. You know, this will be a backup, and I'll email it to you or whatever.
Great.
And I'll let you be the tech as long as that lit thing is lit.
Oh, okay.
Then we're the good old rule of thumb: if the meters are moving and the red light is lit, then we're good. And if you see it overmodulating or anything, then you can move the mic level setting.
Be happy. I just missed calling him before I went to school. Are you happy?
He's happy?
Father? Well, I bug him. Did you remember your backpack?
Oh, so he'll be happy that
when
he missed your call?
Breakfast? Yeah.
God. A little more self-loathing, please. from the lady in the Please Love Me shorts. That works so well. Did you hear what I told Joe as he was going to see Rick? Rick's our counselor too, but it's his counselor. Oh, tell Rick that you're in love with your father.
You're so funny.
Who's dead?
Oh. Rick will love that.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. For sure.
Okay, so. Did I finish telling that one? Yeah, I think I did. That's good tech. It was recommended by Bobby Brands. Good.
All right. I guess this one's running now as well. So, I suppose, should we say our names or something?
Oh, that's true.
This is George Royer.
And what do you do?
No, that's how do you do?
I stay out of trouble.
I'm always teaching you smart people about courtesy. How do you do?
This is Justin Kovar in an interview with George Sanger for the
UT Video Game Archive regarding the seventh guest.
We're going to do all trade-offs like that. Yeah. Just stop in the middle of a question and I'll ask the rest.
Good interview or bad interview.
I'd like to... this is George Sanger on... April 22nd?
Mm-hmm. Or 23rd.
1810.
There was a meteor shower. Last night, on the 22nd, was the meteor shower.
And this is Cindy, let's say, Fisher.
Cindy Red 60.
And she's the reason that you're upset that this is only an audio interview. What's important is the space between the notes. Silence. Yeah. You can use that for noise reduction later.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And I made a huge mistake. I thought that you guys had, like, flown in from Georgia, right?
Yeah. That's why I was like,
yeah.
Where are you guys
from? So we're like big fuss, you know. You gotta have bagels, but we would have done.
We appreciate it. I am from Alabama.
Originally. You know Bobby Prince?
I don't. But I was actually a lawyer in Alabama for two
Get
years.
Get out! How do you guys be so young and married and?
I
triple blades.
Kids? Triple blades. Do you guys have kids?
No. Oh. Nothing to know of. I'm glad that statement's going in the archive.
What kind of law did you do?
I did mass torts and class actions with a large firm in Alabama. I did medical device litigation. I worked with defective pacemakers.
Holy crap, George.
And then I did white-collar fraud stuff as well for 2 years.
So... is it just my prejudice, or am I thinking not everybody can do this, and it ought to be a fairly lucrative gig?
It is. It was. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now you're into recording old men in smelly... Uh-huh. I love you, George.
I decided I'd do something that I enjoyed, that I thought was really important. long term. Thank you, thank you. So somebody's got to be making sure the future knows about this, the newest art form, in my opinion.
Well, it won't be the newest forever, that's for sure.
No, but it is right now.
Well, so. Let me tell you why I think you're smart. Because there's a lot of things about video games that I think that the interesting thing to the people in the future will be what the attitude of people here has been over the last 10 or 20 years toward these games. Because in you people listening to this with your prosthetic eyes and your laser navels and flying cars will and by the way, that's funny because we don't have flying cars. You're probably thinking, oh, games. Sure. Interactive entertainment. I remember when they called that games. We called it living. So when I started doing when I was doing rock and roll and I was trying to be like the Beatles, and I played a couple of the original video games, you know, that I would find entirely on my own. It was like I discovered them. I was Christopher freaking Columbus. I went to the Ralph's grocery store in Eagle Rock and found a Missile Command machine. Mm-hmm. And I dropped a quarter in, and it's like, wow, I understand what this is. And nobody else has. There's these dots, and see, those are like targets, and there's this trackball. Okay, so, and then I'd tell my friends about it. So it wasn't like we were buying into something that everybody else was doing. It was like we were discovering stuff with these video games while everybody else was interested in, commercially was interested in movies, television, disco music, you know, cocaine. And what else? Am I missing anything? That's pretty much it.
That sounds good.
Yeah. It was, and then there was a lot of people trying to get into banking because that's where the money was. And in an effort to be like the Beatles, I saw that most of what needed to be done in rock and roll had been done by then. The beauty of the Beatles was at least partly that they were innovators and that they were trailblazers and that they had something to hit their machetes against. And since all that had been done in rock, I looked at these video games and said, well, this is the future. Well, guys, at that time, it wasn't obvious that those were the future. And it was generally considered a complete waste of time to do video games. There's no such thing as a career in video games. All these things were being done in little shops in foreign countries by mysterious weird people. I mean, we didn't know. To have a career in video games would be like thinking about having a career in, what would it be like? Like having a career in making those little plastic toys that go into the grocery store bubbles. You know, the coin machine things. It just wasn't an intelligent career choice. And that was 78, 79. By the time I started doing this, 83 even, people would say, why would you want to do music for games? They'd say, oh, boop, beep, boop, huh? oh, let's see, by 86, 87, it was, oh, you're the guy who makes that ice cream truck music. So while we were pushing it forward, people were saying, why would you want to do that? When I would find the occasional serious musician who was doing video games, which for the most part I couldn't find, they would say things like, George, if I wrote something good, do you think that I would give it to these people? So it was a... it was not a career in which people were saying, ah, there's money in games. They were saying, ah, what could you do that could possibly be more random? And that's why I liked it. The bar was very low. It's very easy to raise the bar. What a fighter pilot calls a target-rich environment. That's when you're surrounded by the enemy, And what was really nice is somebody could say, do some music for me, and I could do music, and they'd either move on and say, great, thanks, we got the music, or they'd say, that's really nice music. And that by itself is psychologically so healthy. It's so good, and you almost can't get that anymore, because it's like, make some music what I want. I want something that's exactly like this song, but I want it to be more, you know, we were picturing sort of a jazz thing, and then you turn in a jazz thing, and they say, well, you know, the producer really likes Dixieland. And we were thinking more like, that might be good too. So, back then you could, and Seventh Guest was really kind of a peak for that. You guys aren't earning your money here, huh? Well, let me just keep going. I'm happy to.
Actually, yeah. I was gonna ask you to start at the start, which you did, and sort of we'll work our way into how they came to contact you for Seventh Guest. What where Game Audio was then, and how sort of transformed it, and what sort of what your influences were, what led you to make those decisions, and then we can talk too about technical aspects of it.
Okay, well, that's a really good way to approach it, and I think I can do that in a finite amount of time. Did you guys get your bagels and whatnot? Did you get what you needed?
I'm good.
Yeah. I'm almost about to start in a little bit.
Oh. So, brief, a very shallow history working up to Seventh Guest. Dave Warhol was my brother's roommate in college. They were just buddies. And, he went to work for Intellivision. When I found that out, and he's still in the business under the name Real Time Associates. So when I found out that he was in the business, I did the thing that you're supposed to do in rock and roll. I said, hey, can I work for you? I'll do anything. I'll take out the trash. I don't need money. He said, well, George, you're a musician. Why don't you write a tune for me? So I said, okay. And I short version, I wrote a tune for him. He needed to pay me, so they came up with a contract, which I just brought over. I could show you my first contract.
Cool.
So I had to charge him something, so I charged him $1,000 for a 10-second tune. And the company, Intellivision, folded a little bit later. But I got a couple more gigs with my ex-girlfriend's brother-in-law. Who did a couple of things for Atari 800 games. So first game, it was like I just wanted to get into it, and I wasn't even sure that I could compose, and there was no MIDI. So I ran that 3440 machine. I ran my four-track machine, mm-hmm. and played a bass line on guitar, punched it in where I messed it up. And then I rewound it, got on the second track, and played a melody over the top and punched in where I messed it up. And when I got something that I thought sounded good, I wrote it down in music notes and then mailed that through the U.S. mail to Dave Warhol, who then, as a musician in the marching band at Pomona, was able to translate those notes into code. And so that was Thin Ice for Intellivision. The next two games for Atari, I used a little music composer kit cartridge, mm-hmm. and Dave, no, LSD, come on, first name, oh well, Edelstein, lost his first name, but he's still in the business too.
Want me to get your book?
It's in my book. It's don't get it. No, they can. That can be done offline. he broke open the code from the cartridge that the cartridge spit out. And that was an interactive tune, too. What I did for him had little chunks of bass line that would shuffle in between each other, and depending on the tension level, they'd go faster and slower and stuff
Can
like
we
that.
Tell the people from the future what interactive, where...
Oh, what interactive?
When it stopped being just linear composition models and started being interactive.
Well, for me, it was right in 83.
Okay.
Because I did my first one in 83 and my second one in, I think, late 83 or 84.
Okay.
And it was Edelstein's idea to to do something that would change dynamically. This was a first-person maze game, which John Romero went back and said, well, this was a big influence on me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it was, this was Capture the Flag, which was the two-player sequel to Way Out.
Okay.
And basically you're in a maze and you're chasing a monolith. But in Capture the Flag, you've got two players who can each see the other guy's monolith on a split screen on an Atari 800. So that predates Wolfenstein by a long shot.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I was not aware of that game.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't think that it gets recognized
very
much.
I've never seen that written up much.
But it one of the first things that Romero told me ever was that was a big influence on him. So generally it's not believed that there was a lot of interactive audio around those days, but I imagine that if you broke apart some of the Japanese arcade games, you'd find some interactive audio, but you didn't hear people talking about it very much. I was in the right place at the right time, you know, it was the programmer was in the mood to do it. And after the video game home market crash of 84, all these companies went out of business because the Nintendo hadn't come out yet.
Right.
So during that time, I pretty much laid low and learned my recording craft. And later in the decade, I can't remember exactly when, late 80s, Dave Warhol surfaced again. And he was doing Nintendo games. And I had MIDI now, and I had been using MIDI to score songwriters. You know, I'd say, okay, you're a songwriter, here, I'll do an arrangement of your tune for $29, $39, $49, you know, $49.95. And then if I got too busy, I'd raise the price. So I think I was up to about $49.95 at that point, and Dave started hiring me at that rate to do game music. So he would call me up and say, well, you know, this is for things like Dick Tracy on Game Boy and Total Recall and, you know, a lot of these left-right Punch Kick Save the Princess games, which had been reskinned for various intellectual properties. And then a couple of neat things like Q-Bert, you know, for the consoles, not for the arcade.
I remember the Total Recall game on the NES because when you walked through the scanners, it would turn your sprite, would replace your sprite with a skeleton. And that was the first time I'd ever seen, like, dynamic sprite replacement in a NES game that I remembered, and I thought it was totally cool.
I owe you a great apology, because I wrote a lot of music for that game.
Uh-huh.
But the way in which it was implemented, you have to get... You hear one tune over and over and over and over and over. And it went all the way up, and you finally kill your wife. And you're going, okay, this has got to be a turning point.
Nope.
Even after then, it's the same tune. I'm like, dude! So, in that sense, that was interactive audio, because it's got different tunes for different levels.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of where things were at.
Okay. Them.
And even though Warhol has a mind that's always thinking about music-based games and algorithmic composing and things like that, still, the way to do a game was a tune per level, which I hated. And so I learned that it's better to have several tunes per level that get drawn from a pool, and then you should throw more tunes into that pool as you get to the next level. Right? In fact, somewhere around here, it might be at the archive, I put this out as the pool theory, the Team Fat pool theory, and I charted it out for the boys to look at.
Cool.
Oh. That was interactive music. But got an important point in there. So I was sending MIDI files to Dave Warhol, and he had pretty much the only American software that could make tones for Game Boys and NES. And he was known for his tones, which had things like decay and echo. While Mark Miller had pretty much the only authoring system for Sega. So there were just like a couple of ways that you could get a Japanese game developed in America. So I had a lot of the American games through Dave Warhol, because he had the software. Then after a certain amount of time of this, Wing Commander came along.
Can I ask a question? You said Dave Warhol had the software?
He made it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So he crafted his own sort of proprietary
software. Yeah, I think he reverse engineered how the hardware worked. Or he was able to you know, the legend was, and I don't know if I'm perpetuating something nasty that isn't true, but the legend was that the small amount of documentation that you could get from Japanese manufacturers might have had intentionally screwed up instructions in the English version.
Interesting.
Interesting. Yeah. But that's also, you know, I mean, you hear things like that, and you also hear stories that, oh, that gross food that they serve you in the Orient with the maggots in it, that's just special. You know, they do that to bug the Yankees because they're still mad about the war. I really don't give a lot of weight to stories like that, but that was sort of the attitude. Mm-hmm. I think the important part of that is that we all felt that it was difficult to just pop in and start making noises on these machines. Mm-hmm. And since Dave had the key to the NES and Mark Miller had the key to the Sega. Now, Mark Miller's stuff was even authoring tools that a musician could use. Well, that was how we were able to move forward. Meanwhile, I was still doing arrangements for songwriters and such on this MT32, which was the huge breakthrough in synthesizers. And it wasn't so much for the excellent tone, it was more for the number of voices that you could get. You could run 8 different instruments at the same time and a drum kit. Or was it 7 and a drum kit? Or was it, I don't remember. But, and then you could theoretically get 32 different notes at the same time, which you really couldn't. But that in an affordable package was just crazy good, because a synthesizer used to cost thousands of dollars. A synthesizer that could do 2 voices was unheard of, and here's this little box that could do all these things. So I was using that to make arrangements for people. And Dave Warhol says, hey, you should call Richard Garriott. He's doing a high-end PC game. He's in Austin, and he's looking for someone who can write on MT32. So I started writing letters to Richard. And those stories are documented. But I got the Wing Commander gig. Mm-hmm. And again, Chris Roberts decided that he wanted that to be interactive. So that was a big breakthrough, too. The idea was, Chris's idea was, you'd have a tune for You Are Chasing the Missile, you'd have a tune for The Missile's Chasing You, you'd have a tune for Your Wingman's Been Hit. And he had no idea of what the beat situation would be or the musicality of it. But fortunately, Dave Govett wrote the battle music, he kind of already had battle music going in his head. And so he arranged that for an MT-32. I brought it in. Chris liked it. And that was significant, too, because we were, you know, Chris had asked us to do a cross between Star Wars and Star Trek the movie. Mm-hmm. Which is like movie orchestration, and nobody had tried that before for a game. Now everybody does it, but for us it was like a great challenge. And I'm gonna say, Govic nailed it. It still hasn't really, even though the tones are better now, the composition really is no better than what he did for that. So Govic did the main theme and the battle music for Wing Commander. The interactivity level for Wing Commander was very cut and paste. You know, there's a tune that goes pa 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 da pa da 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 da, and then you'd have another one that went wee pa 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 bum 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 pa da pa 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 bum bum. So these things would intercut, and it didn't really matter where the beat was. Now our local guy, Mark Schaefkin, who I still jam with, he was the main implementer. So even though we were just providing the tunes, Mark worked over at Origin, and he's the person you would talk to about how the system works for actually playing those little random bits. But that was so state-of-the-art that when they showed that game at the CES show, it was the hit of the floor, and people were raving about the interactive audio, when in fact, it was just Dave's piece playing through linearly and a recorded clip of dogfighting video. And everyone was like, did you see how interactive the audio was? But when the game came out, it was interactive and it was loved, but people were so hungry for that at that point, and the buzzword worked so well that they got all excited. But really, I think what they were excited about was the level of composition. I think that what they were excited about, and they thought was technology, was that this was beautiful music that was interesting. Because before that, game music kind of went dow 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 boo 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 boo. Instead of bum 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 bum, you know. So I gave a talk at a game developer conference, my first talk. Oh, I went to game developer conference right after Wing Commander came out. And at the first game developer awards show, there was a sound category. And Loom and Wing Commander were both nominated. And then one of the King's Quest games, I think. And Loom and Wing Commander were both mine. And Wing Commander won for that, and that was a really nice moment. And the next year, I spoke at the Game Developer Conference. Art, Music, and the Blue Sword of Gralfalna Blart, which was an attempt to get people to break out of the genres and to stop doing things that had the aesthetic level of the paintings you used to see on the side of a van in the 70s, you know, a caveman holding his loin-skin chick with a dead dragon in the background, you know, all airbrushed. You know, this is a world in which there are more beautiful and subtle aesthetics than that. And that was what I called for. And after that lecture, I got a call from Graham Devine, who couldn't believe he was talking to the famous Fat Man. So that was a really nice moment for me. I hadn't heard of him. I didn't know what he was doing. But what he described sounded very, very cool. And he sent me out a video that pretty much just had climbing up the stairs from Seventh Guest, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it also maybe had one of the picture transformations. I thought, oh man, this is great. So, he was excited about working with me. I was excited about working with him. I got a contract that gave me a percentage of the sales. And it's like, it's the only contract I really worked hard on with my friend Andrew Hallbright. It was a generous contract. And Graham agreed to it. And so I thought, well, I'm on board with this thing. The better it does, the better I do. So I just gave it everything I had. And I probably would have anyway. But while I was writing it, there was this sense that somebody was going to listen to it. And that I would have a captive audience of maybe 100,000 people. And I wanted to give them the best show that I could. Well, that brings us up to the start of the Seventh Guest. So I think that's the first bit. And then I want to say that was rare. It was rare to have access to a kind of resources before. Oh, and by the way, in the long run, I got enough money to buy a Miata.
Nice.
And that was about it, because Trilobite stopped getting their checks from Virgin. And so I stopped getting my checks from Trilobite.
Why did they stop getting their checks from Virgin?
That's up to you, historians. It's generally considered to have been just bad form on the part of Virgin.
Yeah, I should say so.
But
because it sold around 2 million copies, didn't it?
1.5 million right out of the gate. Huh. So, you could ask Rob Landeros. You'd be a good guy to go to for that. And he runs the Facebook page for Trilobite.
Right, yeah. I was looking at that the other day.
Let's see. So, then comes the artistic story, I guess, of doing the music and how I approached it for Seventh Guest, right?
Yeah, I guess the question I would ask is, so they approached you and showed you a bit of a tech demo of what they had going on, and then offered you a pretty generous contract, and it was a pretty sweet deal. So you got on board and you were pretty enthused about it. How did they communicate their needs to you? Or did they sort of approach you and they were just really excited to have you and they were just like, just do what you want?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah. It was that.
Okay.
It was that. And that is the best way to get good work. Because if you figure you're going to be doing something that comes from the heart,
right,
you need to be in a sort of a certain mood to do it really well. If you get up there and someone's saying, you show me 3 other successful games that use this style of music, it's like, you know, you're making love to your person and they say, you know, could you do it right, please? I mean, just the fact that you're being asked that.
Right.
It's just a groove killer.
Gotcha.
So for Seventh Guest, I was very motivated by Graham's confidence in me. Mm-hmm. And the video that I saw, which for you people in the future, was simply an animation that starts at the bottom of the stairs and goes up the stairs in 3D. And by animation, I mean it was a linear rendered 3D graphic. which was very, very state-of-the-art and was being done because of Graham's amazing compression algorithms. He had shown it at a couple of shows years before and had been consistently accused of cheating. So at the shows, he showed the computer playing it. People were always looking underneath the table for the video machine.
Really?
Mm-hmm. To the extent that when he finally gave a talk at GDC himself, his attitude was very poisonous. It was a, look, I told you I could do this, and you all said that I couldn't. So, you know, I mean, he did that as a joke. He's like, so, something I want to say is, Now, getting back to business, right? But it was really there. I mean, that feeling was, he was very resentful. A very emotional guy, very, very brilliant, wonderful. He has famous blogs. He used to put his blog in Wired Magazine. Very personal, very open, and it got him in trouble more than once. He doesn't filter.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So they sent me that video. We came up with a deal, which Graham pretty much said, sure, fat man, anything you say. And so we signed the contract, and I just then had been on the phone with my connection at Roland, who is Tom White, who ever since then was the head of the MIDI Manufacturers Association. But at that time he was the interface between, oh wait, no, he wasn't the head of the MMA yet. He became that a couple years later, but he was the artist liaison for Roland. And I was talking to him about MT32 stuff. I was trying to get him to put out an Avatone sound sheet. That's a little there's one. This little paper record. Trying to get him to do that of some of my MT32 music from Wing Commander and put it out in the game development magazines to encourage people to develop for MT32s. Mm-hmm. That was from the back of a cereal box.
Mm-hmm. I played it.
Yeah. So we were playing around with those ideas, and I said, you know, for my last computer game, I was really frustrated. I was talking to Tom, and I said, you know, I have to write one version of the music for the PC speaker, just one voice, beep, beep, beep. After I had another three-voice version for consoles, after I had a five-voice version for, well, there was a Disney sound card or something. And by the time that I wrote all these different versions, it was no longer interesting to write music. So I had one tune that worked on all platforms. It was about 2 minutes long, and I'm exhausted. Right, and now I got to write the second tune and go through and make sure it works on all the. So he said, well, George, why don't you use the, why don't you write for General MIDI? I said, General MIDI, what's that? How do I do that? He said, just get a sound canvas. Can you give me a discount? No. So I got a sound canvas and I wrote for it. And then I thought, well, some people have ad-lib cards. Oh, and the idea of General MIDI was, it's a MIDI file that can play on all different playback platforms, which was a new idea, and I really liked it. So I wrote that first tune on the sound canvas. I think the first one I wrote was Doorbell. Boom, 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 boom. I call it Doorbell, because bling, bling. And then the second one I wrote was da, 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 da. Which, you know, I mean, that was the first thing I wrote on a sound canvas, right? So, I thought, well, this is good. This is fun. I'm going to write my stuff on this. I'm going to somehow get these same files to play on all the other machines. So I'll work with the programmers and get it so that this file plays all the other synths. So by then I had Kevin working with me, and he and I went into the FM synthesis editor and made a general MIDI sound set for FM, which is still in Windows. Anything that supports FM at this point still has our general MIDI sound set in it. And then I wrote a huge SysX file that if you fit it to an MT32, that MT32 would do general MIDI, more or less. There are technical questions about that. John Miles was a neighbor of mine, and he does the Miles sound drivers that everybody was using for PC. He had just called me up and taken me out for lunch and said, "Hey, I got a couple questions for you." So he took me out to eat, and he said, "Okay, what does MIDI stand for? And why are there black and white keys on a keyboard?" That kind of thing, right? So he went on to become the hugest guy in game audio software, and he's still giant. And we shared a BBS together, so I paid for the phone line at our house, he paid for the computer, and kept it maintained. So there's a little black and white, green and black monitor on the shelf. I think you can see it in that making of video. And when a game developer wanted to make a PC game, he would dial up our modem, our phone would ring, beep, and he'd download the Miles drivers, including the libraries I had that would allow other cards to emulate general MIDI.
So developers dialed into the computer you guys had set up to get the drivers to develop the sound software.
Yeah.
So you're running a distribution point out of your house. Wow. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Because John didn't want to pay for another phone line for himself. And we wanted access to some kind of a BBS so that we could make things available, which I was very kind of clunky at, but I think I had been 300 baud modeming my MIDI files to Dave Warhol.
And what year was with this then?
Wing Commander.
Is that 90?
A little earlier. So a lot of the things like Maniac Mansion, from that back to Total Recall, I'd say is among the very first, or Dick Tracy is among the very first ones that I did for Dave. So that was like that second era, and that was all done by 300 baud modem, and then we occasionally would step up. 600, 1200. We couldn't use, there wasn't general MIDI, so what I would do is I would write the name of the instrument into the file for each track. And it would be like bass drum, hi-hat, and those would never have two notes at the same time. Okay, so that's the track. So it's going, and then I had two other tracks, which is like bass, or and then if I wanted to use a appoggiatura to make it sound like more instruments, then there was always the piano and the flute, piano piano piano, single note flute, piano piano piano, piano arpeggio, flute arpeggio, but always just one voice there, and then the next two voices always just one at a time. So yeah, or you had two boops, a beep, and a pfft. And so I'd make MIDI files like that, which I probably dig up for you. And then I'd email those, or email, I'd modem them, Dave. So for Wing Commander, they didn't know what MIDI was yet. So I had to kind of bring them up to speed on that. Now, if that's not true, Mark Schaefkin will set you straight.
All right.
Oh, and remember, when I'm talking about, this is important, when I'm talking about the state of interactivity and the state of audio for games, this is my perception of it, and there's a whole freaking world going on Amigas and in Japan and Europe that I was completely oblivious to. Okay. So whatever was going on over there just wasn't in my world. I didn't learn anything from them. I didn't copy anything from them.
Gotcha.
So we might have been doing, and I don't think that they learned anything from me or copied anything from me. So there was some nice stuff going on over there, but it was different techniques, different world. And they may have beat some of the things that I claim to have been the first to do. So all credit to them. I mean, guys like Rob Hubbard and Martin Galway, badass mofos. So, back up to Seventh Guest. I'm making these general MIDI files now, and they've got sort of complex setup things at the beginning of them. The first thing that you have to play in the game is this SysX file that tells your MT32, if you have an MT32, it sets the pitch bend range. Oh, the MT32 doesn't have an adjustable pitch bend range. And the it defaults to if you move the pitch bend wheel all the way up, it goes up a whole octave. The sound canvas has an adjustable pitch bend range, and it defaults to one step. So the only way you can make a file compatible is to send a SysX file, send a SysX message to whatever instrument is out there listening to set its pitch bend range. Okay. And that only gets listened to by the sound canvas. So what happened in a lot of cases was that message didn't get sent. So there are a lot of versions of Seventh Guest out there where the pitch bend range just goes instead of but that's fallout of this, you know, this dilemma, this technical dilemma. Uh-huh. So you'll hear tunes like it's supposed to go ooh, and it goes ooh. I think the CDI version, which was a really good way to play Seventh Guest, it had everything right. I think that the Apple version, where they also used a digital rendering, I think that they got it wrong.
Interesting.
But they got the tones right, but they didn't get the pitch bend range right. So you got a pretty good experience on FM, on MT32, on Sound Canvas. And then there was no sort of digital in-game music. There was meant to be. Okay, there wasn't meant to be on their account, but I had a conversation with Graham at one point where I said, okay, Graham, so this thing that you're writing for, it's a CD? And he says, yeah, it's a CD-ROM. Well, is it kind of like a regular CD? Well, yeah, kind of. So can you put digital music on it? Yeah, I think so. Can you play it like a CD, like a record? I think so, I'm not sure. I said, well, how about if I write a bunch of real music for you and put it on there for free? If I write this extra, can you put it on there and like make it maybe be a selling point for the game? You'll sell more copies. And then my little royalty thing pays off. Mm-hmm. He said, sure, fat man, whatever you say. So that's where the violin flourish at the beginning comes in. That's where a Team Fat singing Mr. Foster. That's where my brother's song Skeletons in My Closet comes in. That was all extra that my imagination said, okay, these can be Easter eggs in the game. So if you see that character who's supposed to be singing Skeletons in My Closet, if you click on her, maybe it'll play that song. Or there's a point where you open a book and a weird chant comes out of nowhere. Well, that's the Mystère Far Astor. In the script, it says that you hear this chant. So I thought, well, some son of a gun has got to create that chant.
Yeah.
So obviously it's going to be in the game somewhere. They can't be just assuming it's going to get written by itself. So I called up the writer, Matt Costello, and left him a phone message, which were done on cassette tapes. I left him a phone message and I said, how do you pronounce the words in the script? And he called me back and left a message on my phone tape. He says, Mystère Far Astor. You see where it's going?
Yeah, I do.
Manitas moroto ra, hala hala Astaroth, has has.
Totally tricked him. That's great.
And so I recorded that over to the reel to reel. I played it back at a couple of different speeds at the beginning of that song, at the beginning of the game. So you hear him pronouncing it there. It's Mystère Far Astaroth. And then you even hear the beep, right? Remember that?
Yeah.
So, do you know what I'm talking about? Have you heard it?
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll play it for you. Then I had Team Fat come in. I mean, by then we had just assembled, mm-hmm. and I had no idea how to do a choir, but it turned out they could all kind of sing. So we could talk technically how I did it, but I wrote the pieces out in MIDI. So that I could hear that the harmony worked.
Oh, wow.
Then I played back each part. Ba, 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 ba. I started the ADAT tape, and we all four sang ba, 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 ba. And then I ran it again and punched in ba, 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 ba. So we all sang together the bass line, and I rewound it, and we all sang the baritone line, and then we all sang the, I don't know what you call it, tenor, and then we all sang all four parts.
Okay.
And we'd never sung before. I didn't know whether they could sing or not, but I think it just sounds great. We put a little band thing together with my brother on drums and with Robert Harrison. He was in Cotton Mather, which is a local kind of legendary group.
Your brother was in Asleep at the Wheel?
Yeah, all those Grammy things up on the wall behind my sound effects.
Yeah.
Those are all his.
He won, what, four?
Yeah, four or five.
Yeah. There's a bunch of them everywhere.
Yeah. And his wife is the singer in that now, too.
Okay.
And their baby, his wife, those three follow behind the tour bus in the baby bus.
Yes.
So you people in the future, since the internet will never be erased, see if you can find miles and miles of diapers.blogspot.com. You'll see the history of my brother and my sister-in-law.
Guilty mom.
A little Liesl. Another guilty mom.
That's what most of her blogs are about.
And then we're on the...
She's sick, I know.
She's sick. I think it's the pot that Willie brought on.
She's not on the bus.
Yeah.
That's why they have their Willie own bus. She's a good mom, a super good mom.
Willie loves Elizabeth, and they just did a tour together. And you know, when it's time for them to do their duet, you know, he's like, and now here's the reason I'm on this tour.
Is she singing in the Seventh Guest soundtrack?
Elizabeth, no.
Oh, she's a baby.
She was a baby. She did not exist at that time.
I see. Okay.
She's oh only my God. 33.
So how old would she have been? Math lawyer.
Well, let's see. I'm 29. Seventh Guest came out when I was in middle school.
Okay. So not quite a baby, but...
I primarily went the lawyer route to avoid math, so...
How about you? Do you add?
No, I'm liberal arts.
Oh, you have to read this book I'm reading.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I love math now.
And my book, too. I love
oh,
math,
gosh,
too.
It's about Paul Erdős.
Paul Erdős?
Who's a Hungarian.
Oh, wait. You pronounced it.
It's Erdős, yes.
Hey! Erdős.
Erdős. Erdős is really...
Okay.
Erdős is really interesting.
Dish,
thank
you.
Erdős. He was essentially a homeless genius.
Well, she's reading the book.
Yeah, he would. He lived out of his suitcase for years, and he would just show up at mathematicians' doorsteps in the middle of the night, and they'd knock on, you know, it's Erdős, it's Erdős. He's, you know, let's do math all
night.
You
haven't read the book, have you?
No, no.
How do you know that?
common knowledge, Cindy.
Boy, well, does it like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I know a lot of random stuff, but also my roommate works. Actually, this is, you may find this interesting. Your materials, okay, at the video game archive are being processed in the same room as the math archive. There's the very famous math archive. And,
I forgot about
let's
that.
Let's go.
Yeah, totally.
Well, there's a divider, and it just so happens my roommate, Beth, she is the GRA, Graduate Research Assistant, that is doing the processing for the math collection. There's a little divider. My friend Matthew McKinley is GRA for the video game archive, so he's processing your stuff. So she's over there sitting there processing mostly famous American 20th century mathematicians, a lot of whom corresponded with Erdős. So she's reading his letters.
Let's go.
He's sitting over there, you know, processing your stuff. So actually, your materials are commingling spatially a little bit there. So she comes home after work, and we hang out, and if there's, you know, particularly interesting or humorous letter that she's found, she may give me the gist of it, but yeah.
See how great life is?
It's freaking incredible. Can you go get Ralph's book?
Yes.
So, funny serendipity.
What brought us down that path? Cindy got excited about math. Oh, because we were adding.
We were trying to figure out what year.
Yeah, Elizabeth's age.
Yeah.
I'll show you guys some music I'm doing that's based on some principles I learned from Wolfram, who's... Mm-hmm. You know about him?
She's mentioned the name.
Is he significant, too, or
I
is he just...
really know. Knowledge of math has expanded exponentially since my roommate started working.
Well, I'll tell you what, I couldn't write music to save my life. It was very hard to write music until MIDI came along.
Uh-huh.
And I've since had my brain kind of tested just to kind of see if I was nuts. And thank you. And it turns out that no, I'm not nuts. When I try to make a point, I can make a point. It takes a while to get around to it sometimes, and that's kind of the difference. And if you remove from my IQ scores things that have to be done in real time and in a hurry, if you unweight for that, I'm really smart. So I couldn't do live music that well. But once I got MIDI, I could move the notes around in space, and wow, I could write pretty well. Now, there's a program called Mathematica that Wolfram wrote to do his work, and it's public, and I've got a copy of it. And it is to math what MIDI is to music for me.
Interesting.
So I can solve simultaneous hyperbolas and
that could graph
save it out.
Me so many,
it's
so much sweat in high school.
So where I started getting interested in math again, you know, I was kind of starting to think about it. I set a little goal for myself to be able to understand intuitively and explain intuitively how holograms work. So it's kind of, that was kind of my vague goal, and I had some ideas. And I went and visited, last year, I visited Ralph Baer.
Did you?
Yeah. I stayed the night at his house.
Yeah, I hear he's a nice guy.
Super nice guy.
Really sweet.
And we talked about math a little bit, and he said, I never found a good math book. He said, I decided I was going to write my own. And I went back and read it a couple of years ago, and I couldn't make heads or tails out of it. And he showed it to me, and I said, could I borrow that? I think that I could be very inspired. I'm working on math, and I think that your approach to it could really inspire me. He said, yeah, take it. It's been sitting in the same place for 30 years. So this is his.
This is Ralph.
Ralph's handwritten math book.
Wow, for the folks in the future... Ralph Baer is generally considered the father of video games. He's responsible for the Brown Box, which led to Magnavox's Odyssey.
So in his basement...
This is extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, just the handwriting and the colors of the ink and the way it's bound speak volumes, pun intended, about who this person is.
Yeah, he was an electrical engineer by training, wasn't he?
Yeah. But I tell you what, by chemical makeup, he's a vaudeville entertainer.
Is that right?
He doesn't do that ever. But when he tells a story, it's got the... when he writes dialogue for his little robot bear, it's like, oh, it's you again. Why did you wake me up? You know, and when you play something like Simon, which is one of his inventions.
Yeah, the Simon game, yeah.
Or you play the brown box. It's, you know, the original brown box has this little piece of wood with a hinge on it, and you play a pumping game. You try to pump the water out of the hydrant onto the burning building, otherwise the building burns up. And it's all just kind of, at its core, it's entertainment with as few bits as possible. It's very elegant, elegant entertainment.
Yeah.
Which kind of reminds me of Wolfram. Yeah. So anyway, I was studying Wolfram stuff, and I got some ideas for how to write music based on some of his theories about complexity.
And this was around this time of Seventh Guest?
No, that's this year.
Oh, this year, okay.
That's last week.
Last week, okay.
Yeah. So my most current piece is based on playing a note every beat, then playing a note every other beat, then playing a note every third beat, then playing a note every fourth beat in a loop. So one voice is going boop, boop, boop. The other one's going boop, boop, boop. The other one's going boop, boop, boop. And then I assign a different note of the harmonic series to each one of those loops.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to boop, 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 boop. Yeah, boop, 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 boop. You know, so, but, and you'd think, eh. But we experience it.
Yeah, we'll have to hear that. Sounds cool. So one of the things that I...
we put a band together, we got those guys playing, and we did Skeletons in My Closet, and with, I can't remember her name, singing, but we can look it up, and with Robert singing the game. There.
One of the things I noticed about The Seventh Guest is I was reading about the soundtrack, and you assigned sort of specific musical themes to each character.
If you look in the archive, you'll see there's a little sketch paper.
Mm-hmm.
This is just me wanting to do a good job. You know, I tried to take all these things that had been crammed into me at Occidental College, you know, my music program.
Right.
And I decided, well, I didn't have to be strict about this. But if I had sort of a structure, sort of an idea, then I could avoid writing everything in the key of A or doing the oboe over and over for everything. So I just kind of made a little grid of each character. And I think I also had, like, General Magic or the Dolls or something like that, right? So I had this kind of things that I thought needed to be identified emotionally. And then I assigned a main instrument and a style and a key to each one. And I said, well, you know, that's a nice idea. And every once in a while, when I'm writing for one of those characters, I would I go to the chart. Okay. Oh, okay. What happens here is that Stoff takes over this person's soul. So we'll start in this person's key and their style, and we'll end in Stoff's key. No one will hear it, but whatever. Well, by going through that exercise, I recommend it. I mean, as a student, you can reverse engineer it and say, ah, this is what Wagner was doing. But he wasn't doing it so that you could analyze it and get it perfectly and say, aha, I see what he's doing. He's doing it so that it strikes your ear. It strikes the back of your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't always have to hit there. But it creates a little pattern that your mind might pick up on or might not. And whether you analyze it or not, you feel something changed.
So you wove a narrative structure into the composition to
in a subtle sort of way.
The most unsubtle version of it is when the characters are all being introduced. It is one tune that clicks along at a certain tempo, and it medleys from each person's theme to the next. So, let me see if I've got a... I remember if there's a recording of that somewhere, but it's easy to hear. It comes early in the game. Might even be in the intro. But they just walk in one by one and say one line and walk out. And so you hear the music for each of them happen as it goes. So that's where you can hear it.
Yeah.
And then if you go to the archive and dig around, you'll find something that looks kind of like a grid that's got scrawled notes about, you know, oboe, piano.
So what do you think the legacy of the work you did with Seventh Guest was? I'm asking, trying to put it in its context as you understand it in terms of the medium and the industry.
Well, first of all, like anything of this nature, including what Ralph did and what Erdős did, it's a big, beautiful world, and at some point someone would have done it, right? Someone would have come up with the first hot-selling CD-ROM game. Or maybe it would have taken a while longer if these guys hadn't been dedicated to that project anyway. You know, maybe... maybe it would have happened differently. But I think what's significant about this game being the first one is that it, for a brief moment, it looked like the aesthetics of the new medium were going to be interesting. It looked like it was going to be a renaissance of beauty and craftsmanship and elegant compression algorithms combined and scholarly analyses of interactive dynamics between men and machines, and it was a place where I could be free. If you read the little manifesto up there, you know, that was the mood that I was in, right? You know, this interactive stuff, this is going to be a new frontier, and it's up to us to make it free of compromise. And it looked like it was going that way. And I'm sure at some level, the energy that was put into that game is still cycling around amongst independent game developers, young people who got the crap scared out of them. You know, probably around the level of, you know what, it's like if there had been no The Twilight Zone. That's kind of what it would be like if there had been no The Seventh Guest.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like The Twilight Zone. I think that, kind of gimmicky, kind of corny, but there's an artistic statement to it, there's a feel to it, there's a personality to it, there's an aesthetic, there's a sound. Which, by the way, I did record the guy who played the guitar on that. I did record him myself. That one of the first things that I was a professional engineer on was a Tommy Tedesco record. So there's another connection.
Well, it was Tommy Tedesco. Nice.
He's also the Monkees guitar player. So if you,
oh, really?
Yeah, and he also went on the Gong Show in a tutu.
A lot of people can say that.
Yeah, he's the greatest LA session guitar player of that era.
I have a solo record by him that I love too. But yeah.
What's it called?
I don't remember his title.
Carnival Time?
No.
Autumn?
I don't think so. It's him drawn on the cover with his guitar. And I just remember Tommy Tedesco.
It's not live at the Musicians Institute.
No.
Okay.
That's a studio record. Okay.
Yeah, I've got a record by him. Yeah. So you just inherited it or something?
I found it wouldn't. I'm always a record shopper, and when I lived in Ann Arbor, Michigan, it was just a great place to buy records. Encore Records in Michigan is where I found that.
Are you guys musicians?
Kind of.
I sang in bands for about 10 years, and then I played banjo in a family-style country band in Alabama. Yeah.
And what do you do now?
And now I read books and write papers.
Okay.
Jam invite.
I'm so bad, though. So? I forgot how to play banjo.
That's
I mean,
what
I
want.
Can't do
please,
anything.
Please, please.
I totally, I'm no good.
So, we're here every other month, and every once in a while, on Thursday nights or something like that, we get together in that back room.
Yeah.
Like we did last night. And we get a little crowd of somewhere between 3 and 15 people. And I'm kind of changing the nature of it to the email used to go out to 200 people, but I'm going to kind of pare it down so it just goes to people that would be fun to have out there.
Yeah.
And what did you do?
I came from kind of a DJ background, so I did kind of the turntable stuff.
No way!
Yeah.
Can that be done in a jam environment?
Yes.
Yay!
Yeah, definitely. Because that was always where I wanted to go with it. Was in kind of rhythm, you know, it's kind of an extra rhythm section piece, I think of it as.
And your wife's playing
Justin's
it?
Modest, but he actually
possesses
fairly encyclopedic knowledge of like hip hop. This guy's half your living space is filled with audio equipment
yes.
and records. I mean, he's
just 500 square feet.
So having him, and I guess this actually be a reasonable segue, people in the future, into what we've done with the. My digital migration.
Oh, wait, just let me help them.
Oh.
To you, listening, what he means is people in the present.
That's
you.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. They don't think of themselves as future
That's
people.
Right, I guess they don't.
Any more than we do.
So yeah, this, I guess, would be a good time for you guys to talk tech.
Oh, okay. Well, one of the big things I was wondering is with the PCM tracks, what was the final destination format for those to go onto the CD-ROM? Were those WAV files or like from the ADATs?
DAT.
Huh?
DAT.
Okay.
And I think I might even have a couple of the DATs here that might not have made it into the archive.
Oh, interesting.
But yeah, what I sent them digital audio tapes. Now, background during that gap between 80s. And when Dave Warhol hired me again in the late 80s, I was learning my recording chops and such. But we know it was before that. So around 81 to 83, I worked with Van Webster in LA, and he had a digital two-track recorder, a Sony PCM 1600. And it was like the only independently owned one in LA.
Oh, wow.
So there was one at Sony. And there was Vans. And so when someone wanted to make a digital compact disc, they would call up Van and have him send his boy over to the mastering labs, and I would set up this three cases like this. One was a big microwave looking thing, which was the processor. And two of them were U-matic 3/4-inch video decks, both recording simultaneously because the tiniest dropout was a click. There's no error correction to speak of. So I'd set that up in the mastering labs where they had the lathe and were cutting vinyl. So if anyone ever got to hear the difference between half-inch tape and 16-bit digital on the good monitors,
yeah,
that was me. I had experience at recording digital, which a lot of people kind of didn't even at that time. I had a little DAT recorder, which was a nice thing to have, but really the technical breakthrough, and every once in a while something comes along that you gotta have. I almost count the H2 as that. There's a keyboard, the DX7. When that came out, all the keyboard players were like,
Did you get yours yet? Right, you had to have it. And when the ADAC came out, it was like, oh, dude, gotta have it. I mean, the amount of greatness that you could get. And up until then, you could only dream of having four tracks of audio analog, you know, or like maybe one guy, Joe, had an eight-track analog recorder deck. And it never worked, and you know, it was huge and hard to drag around, very expensive and high maintenance. And then these things came out that would record on, and the tape was hugely expensive. And these things came out that would record onto video cassettes. Freaking brilliant. Mm-hmm. I got to hang out with the guy who invented those too. Who really? Also invented the pod.
Really?
And the Variax.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And who's that?
Marcus Ryle.
Okay.
Runs Line 6.
Were you hanging out with him when he invented the ADAT?
I hung out with him between the pod and the Variax.
Okay.
And I can still call him if I need to. In fact, one of my great overkill moments was when I asked him what gauge strings I should put on my guitar. Because they shipped the Variax. You know what a Variax is, right? It's a guitar that has modeling built into okay. it. So,
another line says it's about the Variax.
Set the dial to banjo or sitar or Telecaster or Strat. And it's got the electronics in the guitar, and that all just kind of comes out the cable. His design secret, by the way, I asked him about it. And that came with really great strings. And then I broke a string, and I wanted to have the same strings on there, so I called him up, and he told me, I said, this is total overkill! But the secret to his inventions is you give people something that they're completely familiar with one new button.
Hmm.
So the ADAT has that digital to analog button.
Okay.
Now, it could have had a million little variables exposed to the user, but yeah. They're buried. And the Variax is the same way. It's just a guitar, and it's got one knob on it that's new.
Okay.
And of course, he could have put, you know, hollow body, guitar size, resonance, you know, all kinds of stuff, but hide it. ADAT was a huge breakthrough. And all of a sudden, I was able to do all the stuff that I learned at Van's studio on the 24-track analog.
Okay.
And all the stuff that I learned from digital recording. I was able to throw out a lot of the caution and practice that we used to use because we couldn't bounce tracks very much.
Okay.
And we had to record. It was always very good practice to put all your effects on ahead of time when you're recording to analog tape. But...
Oh, because you didn't want to lose a generation?
You didn't want to lose a generation. Okay. And you wanted it, you know, yeah, that's a good way to put it. But I found that I could record, as long as I got something onto the tape, I could affect it on the way back. I could get something back out of it, because there's no tape noise. And I gave myself permission to do infinite bounces.
Nice.
So I had, for Seventh Guest, I had one ADAT machine and one DAT machine.
Okay.
And I can't remember exactly how I synced to videotape. I believe what I did was I made a copy of the videos that they gave me. I made a VHS to VHS copy, and I put audio on one channel and SMPTE on the other as I bounced.
Okay. Because on the first track of a lot of the ADATs, it's, yes. And I was thinking it was SMPTE time code. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's on the ADATs. So what was chasing to what? Oh! The MIDI would chase to the ADATs.
Okay.
Now, how did I... I didn't have video that would chase, so I must have at some point... Oh, sure. I would have the... I would do as much as I could in in, yeah, that makes sense. I'd run the video, and I'd be composing in MIDI in sync with the video.
Okay.
So the computer, that can chase to the SMPTE real easily. So I believe that anything that's in sync with video in Seventh Guest is all MIDI.
Okay.
And then I would have put it on the... I don't remember why I would have put it on the ADAT. Maybe just as a reference for where the video would go, or maybe... I don't really remember. But for 11th Hour, I had a second ADAT and a BRC.
Oh, nice.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you can explain that to the people in the future. And so I was able to do SMPTE offsets and stuff like that, and I didn't have to record SMPTE onto the tape.
I don't know. I just know the BRC is a remote control for...
It's a big remote control, but it also... it allows you to offset where each tape is located in relation to the other one.
Okay.
Whereas if you don't have that, then if you have two ADATs, they run exactly in sync.
Nice.
So on Seventh Guest again, I had just the 8-track ADAT, and I had a DAT machine, and what I would do is I would take 8 tracks of ADAT, and I would mix them onto 2 tracks of DAT.
Okay.
And I'd find a blank ADAT tape, bounce the 2 tracks of DAT back up to that, and add a couple more things.
Okay.
And I'd do a mix of those tracks down to 2 tracks, and I'd go back and bounce it again.
Okay.
And I did, you know, sometimes up to 4 bounces, I think. And it never seemed to sound bad. I was delighted. I mean, I just felt like I was free.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could never do anything like that in a 24-track recording studio. And I always challenged myself, you know, wow, if I had 4 tracks like the Beatles, I could do infinite stuff. And there I was with 8 tracks, better than the Beatles, so I better put something good out. So I did. Nice. I tried to.
Yeah. And so there, as you were bouncing back and forth, there wouldn't necessarily be multi-tracks of everything then. There would be...
You could, unless I went back and erased some things, which I think for the most part I didn't.
Okay.
You could do a complete remix.
Huh?
But you'd have to be very careful. You'd have to first do a submix of, you know, you'd have to find the oldest tape that had the least instruments on it. You'd have to find something that has individual instruments on it. And like for instance, the session that it shows just a little bit of us doing the game, you see a little bit of a session in that video. That probably has a bass, 2 guitars, and 5 tracks of drums.
Okay.
Or something like that. And then, so that there's probably that exists. And then I would have mixed that down onto a 2-track, the game instruments only, or okay. Basics. We would have called that basics or rhythm tracks. And I would have bounced that back to a clean tape, had the vocalist come in, and now he sings along with that tape. And now if there's any leads or things to add to that, then I can add those to that tape.
Okay. And do you think with the time code on there, do you think there's any points where to reconstruct it you'd have to also have MIDI tracks? Or is everything on the ADATs, do you think?
That's a good question. You might very well need the MIDI tracks, but the MIDI tracks all exist.
Hmm.
And whatever I have is at the archive, in one form or another. If you bring it up in Motu Performer, it'll come up with the correct SMPTE offset built into it.
Oh, wow.
It'll probably come up waiting for external sync. You know, It'll probably, if it's something that needs to be synced and isn't just an independent in-game tune, it'll probably come up in like waiting for SMPTE.
Okay.
You know? Wow. So it should reproduce pretty well, I think. So things like, it'll be a good kind of combo piece. Well, Skeletons in My Closet has horn parts that are on the synth.
Yeah.
So that would be, there's somewhere a MIDI file of the horn parts for Skeleton in My Closet, and there's one audio track that's got vocals, instruments, and a SMPTE track.
Okay.
So that you can play the two together. And who knows, I might have mixed that directly to DAT, I might have mixed it to two tracks of ADAT, I don't know.
Okay.
What else? Technically.
Do you want more coffee? I will make more
coffee.
Sure.
Okay, I'll go for that bit more.
You doing okay,
Cindy?
With the
chocolate? Oh, you know I love learning stuff.
Oh, I actually have a question for you. I tried to research this and I couldn't find out. Who is European Sex Machine?
He's a very, very smart guy.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Is that a band?
Okay, you know what Sprockets is, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with the Mike Myers?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, years before that, it occurred to me that the ultimate pop hit, you know, that if you wanted to make something that would be very awesome and would seem exotic, it would be like these European twins who, like, think that they're doing the blues, but they're really not.
Nice.
You know, so they've been, and at the time, me and Dave, Brother Dave, and a friend Gary had monthly songwriter club meetings. Uh-huh. That was where Dave wrote Skeletons in My Closet.
Okay.
We'd each have to bring in three tunes during the month. And I had been talking about, you know, a great band name would be European Sex Machine.
Uh-huh.
And that would be, I mean, of course people would love that.
You don't even want to know what came up when I tried to Google that and figure out what it was.
Did you find the website?
No. I was afraid to click on any of the
it's
things.
Very,
that
it,
I
it's
found.
Very hidden, but okay. I'll click you to it. Did you hear anything by them?
I did not.
Do you know Mr. Death?
Yeah, the track on the soundtrack. Yeah.
Okay. That was like the second or third European Sex Machine tune.
Yeah, because that band did that for Seventh Guest. Right? Yeah.
They're awesome.
Yeah. Okay. People of the future. So, I'll show you the website for them.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a must. Because there's a whole album's worth of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you haven't heard all their stuff?
You only heard Mr. Death.
Oh.
Was Rob Landreth connected with them, too?
He did a... he wanted to be their record company. So he did up... He's a big fan. So he did up artwork and... He put this album's worth of material out as a CD, theoretically, and then put it for sale on his website. And unfortunately, he sold one. So he had to actually make a physical CD.
He sold one.
Uh-huh.
That's it.
And check it out, I found out who bought it.
Who?
It's an Eagle Scout friend of mine who said, "Hey, George, no, my mom found out I was into European Sex Machine, so she went on the internet and bought me their CD."
Which Eagle Scout?
The one who was over here with the red beard.
I was going to say the one that looks like him.
Yeah, that one.
All right.
Barbarossa.
Knew it.
to say, Travis True.
It had to be.
He's got one of those Texas only names. Gatlin Johnson.
Mm.
Okay. Yeah.
That's interesting.
He's a cool dude, too.
Well, what else?
Well, that about sums up the questions I had for you.
Yeah, and I mean, that pretty much gets to the technical stuff. And unless you want to talk about, intention at all, do you think archivists should try to reconstruct almost the full multi-tracks if we could? Because I know it's definitely never going to be the same as your mix.
Okay.
Because you're adding effects.
This is where I find myself philosophically in a beautiful limbo. Because when I heard about the archive, when we started to form it, I had, at that point, completely convinced myself to clean all the shit out of this place and throw it out. So, all the gameplay music stuff was in that metal trash can that's in the bathroom right now. Mm. All the cassettes were in it. We had our first meeting for the game archive. And I said, well, what kind of stuff are you going to want? I said, well, what have you got? I said, well, I've got a LucasArts map of the interactivity for Monkey Island, you know, that Mike held up to me and said, hey, check this out. This is how, this was our map for the entire game. Look at all these circles, and this is how we knew how to transition from one section to another. I said, are you done with that? He said, yeah, and I grabbed it out of his hand. I said, coo.
Wait,
he said, this is mine now.
You get to keep that?
It's up in the bathroom.
Are you kidding me?
If ever there was a treasure map, real treasure map.
That's for the first Monkey Island?
I think it's for three. I think it's for the pirate singing.
Yeah. That's a great game.
That which was a peak of Monkey Island-ness. You know, I mean, it was a real iMuse high point. So they asked me about that, and I said, and I got a bunch of cassettes from this project that I did that are just, you know, that are in my trash can. Take them out of the trash can. Really? You want that? Yes. So, on one hand, I don't think any of this stuff should be kept.
Interesting.
Right?
See, I think it
but wait, but that's too extreme, right?
Yeah.
And certainly, keeping everything is too extreme. I mean, because you can't experience the past in full resolution. You can only experience compression, right? I mean, you've got a compression issue. As soon as you compress something, you introduce the possibility of error. You guys know that. It's basic information theory. Any amount of squeezing together you do beyond actually experiencing something introduces the kind of error that you're trying to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're trying to do ultimately is impossible.
Right.
You have to live through something to experience it. Now, at what point do you say, damn, just screw all this stuff. Go out and ride a horse. Right? I mean, really comes the question of intention. What do you think might be learned in the future? And we can't really determine that.
Rather impossible to say what people will see in it. They could see, I could think of 100 ways that they could even look at this interview and look at it from different perspectives, and just, there's just no telling.
If we're making cave drawings, I make a cave drawing, and I'm about to erase it. You say, hey, Og, leave it. And I'm like, why? It's, you know, I need that wall for my next painting. You go, no, leave one. Why? It's for the future. Well, what are we saying to the future?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Right? So I think here's where I draw the line. If it's going to make...
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, man.
If it's going to make
Thank you so much.
Brenda Gunn, happy. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was just grinning at the idea of getting this stuff. If it's going to make Zeke happy to have this stuff. Zach.
I like calling him Zeke.
You do?
It's cool.
Don't tell him I said that.
But if he ever listens, he'll... Zach's good.
Never want him to think that I anything but love him.
We love Zach.
He's great. Yeah, he's really great.
Big heart in that skinny body, you know. That's what puts me over the edge for doing it. Now, the benefits that come to me, now that I've made the decision based on I want him to be happy, well, now all the pressure, for me, not having the archive, the selfish reason, or not having thrown the stuff out, the selfish thing is, if I didn't have the archive, I'd have all this stuff that I'd be throwing out, and someday, maybe my son wants to see that thing that he grew up with, or maybe he wants to show a friend, or maybe my daughter remembers something and she wants to, you know, I've got, look, here's an ostrich egg that Chris Crawford gave me. Well, instead of going, I just threw that out, I can give it to the archive, and I can say, kids, it's in the archive if you're ever interested. And that removed a lot of indecision for me and a lot of potential guilt, which I think if I had been truly strong, I wouldn't have had to deal with. I would have said, everything is temporary. There it goes. I am made to look forward, not back.
But, yeah.
But there's people who like to look back and who learn from looking back. Look at how much we're getting from studying Erdos and Ralph Baer.
Mm-hmm. Right, which they have his material, some of his material. They have some of Baer's materials.
He went through and toured. I think he donated a couple of things.
I
tried to kind of gently get this passed over there. Yeah. He wants it back. I think he wants it in the Smithsonian.
Okay. They have some of his stuff already over there, don't they?
Yeah, and he's the kind of guy, he likes to say, my stuff's in the Smithsonian, and he likes to say, well, I'm going to Washington to be inducted into the Inventors Hall of Fame. I don't know why they picked me. You know, but he's very humorous about it. He wields his power with a firm and humorous hand.
He likes to say that people always ask him, oh, you invented the video game? Which one?
No idea what the concept of video game is. I invented the concept of video games. Ah.
It's so cute.
He's an older guy now. He's in 90. Is he in his 90s?
He's just coming up 90.
Yeah.
He's going into it for an operation.
His birthday was in March.
When's the operation? It's like now.
It's like in a week or something, isn't it?
So he's going to have his heart worked on, and he's very apprehensive.
Is he okay?
Might not be, and we have plans with him if he makes it. That's what he keeps saying.
Yeah. Bill Bottorff, whose idea this thing was, this archive.
Bill's amazing, too. He's a really special person.
I don't know what you... Someone's got to do something with Bill. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Bill's a different story. I mean, just for the sake of the archive on this tape, I was working on my roles at that meeting. Was that you humming? I thought it was my phone buzzing.
It's your phone.
Oh, I think it was mine.
Oh, it's his phone.
Okay.
We're all so tuned to that sound, huh? It's like...
The day that picture was taken of the rolls was a tech meet, and all the rolls guys, and then the background is blue screened in. The out-of-town expert looked at my car and said, oh, she's going downhill and accelerating. He said, you got to give up, George. You're flogging a dead horse here. And, you know, she's leaking oil, the brakes are bad, you know, this is bad, that's bad, everything's bad, give up. And I said, well, couldn't I just put her up on bricks and work on her for the rest of my life? And he said, I don't think they make lifetimes that long. So I was kind of stricken, and I was out by the sidewalks, or wondering what I should do, because that was my only car. You know, I mean, my wife's got the van, but so But that's hers. So Bill sees me out there, comes up, and he's like Mickey Rooney. He's like old Mickey Rooney. He's like, well, George, you know, I always wanted to talk to you about this. Yeah, we met the other day. Or, we talked a little bit, and he understood where I was at. And he said, tell you what, I don't know why I didn't think of this before. Me and Richard Garriott and Warren Spector are putting together a video game archive for UT. You ought to come along and be part of this. You need to be part of this thing. That's just one thing he did. He also, he decided he wanted to hang out with Ralph Baer. So while he was in Massachusetts, he looked up Ralph Baer. Now all of a sudden, he and Ralph Baer are buddies. George, you got to be pals with Ralph Baer. You guys have totally hit it off. He sets me up as a buddy with Ralph Baer.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Is that the day you took that picture?
He made that print.
And you did this picture too.
Yeah.
You made that. Yes. Composition.
He gave me a guitar. He gave me a bunch of tube amps. And this wonderful little record player. But he's just an angel. You know, he just keeps coming up with these brilliant... I think he's just open to the messages of the cosmos. If he puts you together with somebody, pay attention. Mm-hmm. And his idea is that we should do something with Ralph based on the comic Bear character. So that is definitely high on my list of things to keep an eye out for. When you meet somebody like that, who's got the gift, you can't explain it, but you pay attention. My dad has that gift with diagnoses. If he says, well, let's see, what's your problem? Oh, I'm having trouble walking. Take an aspirin and a sitz bath. Like, Dad, nobody does sitz baths. You take an aspirin and a sitz bath, all of a sudden you're up and dancing again.
Is your father a physician?
Is mom too.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. They're both really great diagnosticians. Uh-huh. So when you meet somebody who's got that, the eye, mm-hmm. That's really the character. That's the characteristic. That's what Iyengar, the yoga guy. Mm-hmm. People ask me how I know these things. Well, I know I have the eye. Mm-hmm. And there are composers who say, I don't need to listen to your music. I can see it in your eyes. Mm-hmm. People who have that sort of, I like to call it the mysterious fifth sense. But they're very valuable. People who hit the nail on the head over and over again, it's a gift. It's a characteristic. They know how to look at things. So where were we? Oh, we were talking about Bottorff and Ralph Baer. And we were kind of closing up. How's Ralph doing? And
yeah, I guess. That about covers everything that I wanted to know about Seventh Guest. Okay. And then got some wonderful information on the sort of history of game audio and your history as well, which gives a good bit of context to pieces of the collection, I think.
Okay. Well, the people in the future can feel free to animate, get a picture of my face, a photo of me, and animate the lips. Mm-hmm. To the automatically,
right.
To the syllables that are pronounced.
And we can be fairly certain that they don't have time travel because none of them have showed up mm-hmm. here.
Well, what I'm thinking is they probably did show up.
You think so?
Set things up exactly the way they needed to be.
Uh-huh.
Went back, destroyed all traces.
Because you don't want to ruin the continuum.
Time paradox.
And then destroyed the time machine. And that's why everything's so tied together and perfect. Okay, well, that's my recording.
I'll show you guys. Yeah.